ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Natasha Mitchell here. Hey, ABC Radio National's Top 100 Books Vote. It launches next week, and I would love you to be part of a very special kids book event for it if you are in Melbourne next Tuesday, the 1st of September. Join me with superstar kids authors, including Australian Children's Laureate Andy Griffiths, to talk debates in kids' literature, but also our favourite kids' books, which we want to see make the vote this year. You can head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll down, look for B&R Audience to grab your free spot before they book out. What better way to celebrate the first day of spring, hey? Look, more superstars on the show for you today. From the page to the stage to the screen. When a book becomes a hit TV series or a play becomes a Hollywood film, in your mind, what makes it a great adaptation? Today on Big Ideas, you'll meet the creative brains behind the international hits Slow Horses and Prima Facie.
A lot of agents say to playwrights early on in their career, it was said to me early in my career, just write a novel and then we can sell it to Hollywood and then you can write a play. I went, but I want to write a play. Like, I don't understand this logic.
There was one moment where they were talking through a scene with me and they said, oh, and this is the point where Jackson Ann will say to River Cartwright, bleh, whatever the line was. And I went, that doesn't sound like something
in the book.
Jackson would say to me. And they looked and one of them said, Mick, it's in the book. At which point I just accepted that they knew what they were doing.
Yes, it's a joyous Sydney Writers' Festival conversation with the British novelist Mick Herron, author of the Slough series of spy thrillers about a dysfunctional team of failed MI5 spooks. The sixth season of the acclaimed TV adaptation Slow Horses is due for release next month. Mick's Down Cemetery Road novels have also been adapted for television. And lawyer, playwright, screenwriter and novelist Susie Miller, whose film adaptation of her Laurence Olivier Award-winning one-woman play, Prima Facie, will premiere at the Toronto Film Festival next month, starring Wicked's Cynthia Erivo. This story about the criminal justice system's handling of sexual assault cases has been turned into a novel as theatre. It's been produced in 48 countries, more than 20 languages in the UK. It was so impactful, it led to reform of the criminal justice system. She's also the pen behind the plays RBG of Many, One and Inter Alia, which will be released as a novel next month. And her new play, Strong is the New Pretty, about the birth of the AFL Women's League, will premiere in Brisbane from next week before travelling to Canberra, Sydney and Geelong, which I'm getting along to that one for. They're joined in conversation by someone else who's worked across multiple mediums, broadcaster, writer for screen, stage and print, Benjamin Law.
Now, the session today is called Great Adaptations, and you might remember in the Oscar-winning movie adaptation how Nicolas Cage, playing a fictional version of the film's real-life screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, is very quickly driven to a complete nervous breakdown during his process of trying to adapt The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlin, played by Meryl Streep. And that's because the adaptation process, turning a best-selling book into a TV show or film or stage play, can be incredibly fraught. After all, what sings so subtly on the page can easily land with a thud on the screen. And if you're an author, how do you know you can trust a TV creator to whom you're handing over your precious book baby? How do you stop yourself from interfering? And should you interfere? And how do you dramatise the rich internal life of a character? And what if everyone watching it thinks, ah, the book was better? So you can see why Charlie Kaufman lost his mind. Prima Facie, which has had like a billion lives, and I want to talk about all of them, It's already been on the page, stage and screen. It's travelled the world and now it's returning to, well, it's returned to Australia and
yes,
here in Sydney
yes.
it's going to return to the Roslyn Packer with director Lee Lewis and actor Sheridan Harbridge, who originated the role of Tessa.
She did.
So this play has travelled far and wide, but I want to really go back to the beginning because prima facie had quite small, humble beginnings.
It did, at the Griffin Theatre, 120 seats.
That is a tiny theatre,
yeah.
right? Mm. Tell me about those early days of writing and developing what would become Prima Facie.
So I wrote it in a sort of hot, intense kind of fury of sorts. And as I wrote it, I thought, well, it's actually the right time for my craft to write this because I've got a bit of maturity and I've thought about these issues since I was at law school and now I've actually got a structure that I really want to sort of pour it into. And so I wrote it in a sort of hot frenzy because I think the Griffin Award was coming up and I thought I'll put it in.
Yeah.
And at the time I thought, I'm not sure how I would ever get this on because how would I pitch this show? It's a show about sexual assault. It's about a rape. And it's a one-woman show, and it's a bit funny. I thought, who's going to put that on? Mm. I can't even imagine someone pitching it to me. And I did think at the time that one of my goddaughters, who's an actress, who's actually currently on stage at the moment here in Sydney, but I thought, well, you know, Lottie could always take it to the old Fitz maybe and do it sometime or do it in a small pub somewhere. So I thought, oh, it'll have a life somewhere along the line. And then it did win that award. And then it went on at the Griffin. And it was an interesting time for me because actually my mother was dying. She died the day before the first preview. I flew back up for the first preview from Melbourne. And I remember the first preview really distinctly because there were a group of young boys, 14-year-old boys from a private school in Sydney who had been brought there by their drama teacher with no knowledge of what this play was really. And they each had, to my horror, a packet of crisps.
Which is great for the theatre.
Oh, yeah. Especially a small theatre like that. So, and Lee Lewis and I couldn't get a seat, so we sort of squashed together on the stairs with all around us. And I remember afterwards they came out and they were so... First of all, the audience were amazing and they kind of leapt to their feet in this sort of magnificent wave almost. And these boys were part of that. But they came out afterwards and they were desperate to kind of get Sheridan to sign their scripts. And they were sort of in this innocent, exuberant kind of excitement. One of them said to me, in absolute full innocence, he said, wow, we didn't even know that was rape. And the teacher and I looked across at each other and I went, therein lies the problem. These are the boys that are about to go out there dating our daughters and other people's daughters and other boys. And they don't know that this is something that's actually, you know, like a terrible crime that can cause terrible harm. And, you know, it was like, wow, this we really do need to see this play. And the teacher was amazing. And these boys didn't even realise before they went in there. And at that age where they're going to stop talking to their mothers and their sisters about what's right. So it was interesting.
I'm trying to remember the timeline. Like, I feel like Prima Facie kind of came out and it dovetailed with that first crest of the Me Too movement. Am I right in remembering
that? Yeah, well,
that?
I read it before Me Too, but yes, it did. I think it was the first year, because I think it went on in 2019, and Me Too kind of came about maybe 2018.
Uh-huh.
And so it was the first time Griffin actually sort of had Me Too on anything in the program. So, yeah, it did very much kind of connect with that and then kind of kept going.
So here you are, you're having incredibly interesting conversations with school teachers, with young people as well. I know you had fascinating conversations with people in the law who had also
actually, I thought at the time, because I had been a playwright for many years then and I'd left the law in 2010, but I thought this play might be the one time where I get abandoned by all my lawyer friends because it was quite critical of the system. Mm. And actually, in fact, the opposite happened, which was really heartening for me and made me go, oh, I love the way lawyers are prepared to sort of intensify their interrogation of the system itself when presented with a kind of juxtaposition of anomalies. Mm. So that was really heartening for me. And the same thing happened on steroids in London because they actually changed the law. And, you know, like a judge called me very soon after the show went on with Jodie Comer on the West End and basically said, look, you know, I've been up all night having seen the show, you know, and I've rewritten the direction to the jury and I wanted to ask your permission to use some lines from your play. And I thought, you know, that was a five-minute call. I first of all thought, the next call is to my husband because I think they're about to sue me. Or we better get the house out of my name. But that five-minute call, you know, I did a law degree, I practiced for 15 years, I did a master's in law, I talked about law left, right and centre, but that 5 minutes made me realise the power of art, basically.
That is phenomenal.
wasn't me. She did it. So,
yeah. I'm going to do something that they call foreshadowing now.
Okay.
So here we've got Prima Facie. It's a hit play. It's becoming a cultural moment, actually, and a phenomenon that's changing things practically in a real, tangible way. When was the moment you had the first inkling that it might warrant another incarnation?
Oh, really good question. I think from the very beginning, because it was a one-person show, so I was expecting a lot of an actor to learn 90 minutes worth of text on their own. But the original version probably would have run for 3 hours. So in order to cut some of those scenes out, I put them in what I call the garage. Which is like a file on your desktop that doesn't mean you deleted them. But when I did it this time round, because I do it with all my plays, I put them in the garage thinking one day I'm going to use those scenes because I really like those scenes and I would love to have them in the play, but I can't possibly expect an actor to stay on stage for 3 hours. And so I always thought, you know, in the book or in the film or whatever, I'll drag them back out. So it was my way of being able to reduce, which is what you have to do, as you know, as a playwright, that you have to completely always like take things out, like kill your darlings. And I thought, I'm not going to kill them, I'm going to put them in the garage for use later. And sure enough, when I wrote the novel, which is not the next incarnation, but I think that's the best way of doing an adaptation. When I wrote the novel, it was just this joy of going, I've got these great scenes that I loved and now I can weave them in and expand on them. And, you know, there's something lovely we were just talking about writing a novel where you're in your own space, in your own head, in your own story. You feel like you exist in the world you've created. You don't have actors and directors breathing down your neck saying, oh, no, I don't want to say it like that. But, you know, and then I wrote the film. But this time I wrote the film before the novel. And I think that was problematic because then I had to go back and redraft the film because I found things in the novel that weren't yet in the film.
I can't wait to talk about both of those incarnations and the processes of both.
Yeah.
I mean, Mick, similarly to Susie, but in a very different way, you have forged these universes that exist on the page and the screen. These books of yours, the Zoe Bowen books, the Slough House novels and novellas that now are, you know, beloved franchises on the shelf and on the screen, also had pretty modest beginnings, wouldn't you say? Like, how modest are we talking about?
Well, they didn't have any readers. I mean,
That's pretty modest,
yeah. It started slowly and quietly. I mean, with Slow Horses, the first novel in the series, was my sixth novel. But I didn't have a readership at this stage, which is quite liberating in many ways because there are no expectations on you. And also, there's a freedom to do exactly what you want. Well, I did have a publisher, which was good. I didn't have a publisher after I wrote Slow Horses, but I did at the time. And I knew that, I felt that this was a book I was writing for myself. These were characters I was inventing for my own entertainment.
For your own entertainment?
Well,
so just give us an idea of where writing these books sat for you at the time. It doesn't sound like you were necessarily... Were you a full-time writer devoting yourself here?
No. I could have been, but then I would have starved to death quite quickly. No, I'd established to my own satisfaction what my career was going to be, which was that I'd get up every morning, go to work, come home, write for a bit, and these books would be published and they'd end up on my shelf, which was great, and my mum was getting them as well, which was nice. That was about it. They were in libraries a bit. You didn't see the books in bookshops at all. And I was fine with that. I was okay. I mean, there was a point a few years earlier when I thought I was going to write a book that I hoped would be more of a hit, you know, try to write something that would be, I don't want to say bestseller, but at least noticed in some respect. And that didn't happen. I mean, I wrote the book, but nobody paid any attention. So that settled the question of whether or not I was going to be commercially successful. And it was quite a relief to think that I wasn't, because it meant that I could just carry on doing what I was doing. I only had myself to please, and my publishers, and it turned out I didn't please them very much afterwards.
I think you might be the most relaxed author ever about those low kind of like readerships.
Well, looking back, I was a bit stupid, I think, yeah. But I write because that's what I do. It fulfills something within me. And it's not like there were years of struggle. I often get taxed with this as if I had this awful struggle to overcome, you know, for no change. I didn't. I was fine. I mean, I had a job. Working is important. Working is a good thing to do. I wasn't hungry, you know. I had food on the table. I had a roof over my head. So the writing was purely my own personal luxury, I suppose. Mm. And, you know, it did pay dividends in the sense that I had these books on a shelf, and that's what writers want. I'd never written with the idea of there being an end point beyond the novel. I'm often asked, I mean, it's a standard question that novelists get, you know, has anything you've written been turned into a movie or onto TV? As if the novel is just a staging post on the way to a different screen life. I have friends who paint pictures, and nobody says to them, oh, that's a nice painting. Is it going to be made into a sculpture? Writing is the one thing where the idea that it's going to be transformed into an entirely different medium by a whole load of other people is seen as some kind of evolution, you know, sort of a triumph, if you like. Whereas for me, the novel is the triumph. That is the end. Anything that happens to it afterwards is a byproduct. And don't get me wrong, I'm delighted with the byproduct that has come about. Mm. But it's not like I was writing with an eye on the screen or thinking, with any luck, one day this will be turned into an ice skating extravaganza with characters by Walt Disney performing all the actors. You know?
So from very modest beginnings, and I think Slow Horses was published in 2010, the publisher declined to publish the next book in the series because of those modest sales, and Down Cemetery Road and its three following titles, sales were soft initially as well. What changed, and when did that start changing for you?
The change started happening around about 2015, I think. And I had always thought, and this is a deeply naive thing looking back on it, I'd always thought that if the books were any good, they would find an audience. That is naive because it completely overlooks the impact that being published well has on a book. And I'd never been published well up until that point, other than in the States a bit. What happened was that, partly I like to think there was a kind of mood shift, I suppose, in the UK, that led to, you know, my books seeming more, I don't know, relevant than they had been before. My books are, some of you may know, are quite pissed off with the way things are, and around about 2016, see, most everybody else was as well, so it kind of chimed more with the national mood, I suppose. Mm. But mostly it was to do with being published well. I was taken on by John Murray Press, and I got told a while, afterwards for a few years, I was told, oh, this is a real word of mouth success you become. That's fantastic. These are very rare. And I suppose it was, but an awful lot of time and effort went into creating that word of mouth success on behalf by the publishers. They created this. There was one moment where, this must have been in 2015, I think, where my new publisher, Mark Richards, decided that he was going to give away copies of Slow Horses with the Evening Standard, which is a free newspaper given away mostly at London railway stations. He gave away 10,000 copies, which at the time was the biggest giveaway ever. Ooh. Now, I was commuting into London, but I wasn't at work that day. But I was going to London in the evening, funnily enough, to see an author give a reading at Waterstones in London. So I was getting off a train at about 6 in the evening when a lot of people were coming. Commuters were going home, getting onto the train. And there were hundreds of people walking down the platform holding copies.
All right, wow, okay.
It felt
I hope you
like
got a photograph of that.
I wish I had. That was strange. So I suppose that was the first of the moments when I thought, actually, something is happening.
And happen it did, as Mick Herron went on to become a best-selling author with a critically acclaimed hit TV show, Slow Horses. Today on Big Ideas, he joins playwright, screenwriter and novelist Susie Miller and Benjamin Law. Natasha Mitchell coming to you across the nation on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen or wherever you hear your podcasts. We're talking great adaptations at the Sydney Writers' Festival. And listen up, because Hollywood could be watching or reading your work.
Well, so now you know you've got a hit and a phenomenon on your hands. Then, you know, something interesting happens when a book becomes a bestseller. It starts becoming courted. Courted by production companies, courted by people within television or film who have a vision that they want to pitch to you. Can you give us an idea of what those conversations, what that courting process was like for you?
Well, weirdly, this happened before the books had become
really
successful in the way that they were. This was It's actually during the point where I didn't have a UK publisher. There was my third novel in the series was the first to be published by John Murray. That wasn't actually published at the time that various small production companies expressed an interest in an option. I was very relaxed about that because I thought it's fine because this is not going to happen.
Right.
I'm happy to go along and have a meeting, but I didn't believe for a moment it was going to happen. I'd had this before when my first novel was published, although nobody paid any attention to it. There was interest from a production company who took out an option on it. And at the time I thought, oh, great, this is wonderful. Of course, nothing happened. What did happen was that the person who took out the option grew old and died. That happened sometimes.
Oh, right.
So that interest went away. And I also discovered something interesting. If you publish a novel that gets well-reviewed in the American trade press, now that's Publishers Weekly or Kirkus Reviews, which don't get read by the general public, but they're for booksellers, really. Mm-hmm. If you get well-reviewed in there, particularly if you get a starred review, you will get contacted by people in Hollywood saying they want, you know, they're very interested in this book. They haven't read the book. They don't know the first thing about the book. I had emails about my third novel, I think it was, saying, oh, we understand you've written this classic English mystery novel. And I thought, it's English, but it's none of the other things at all.
Yeah.
And so what happens is you send away the book and you never hear another word about it. My feeling is that there are people who work for Hollywood production companies, who just scan the trade press and they send out emails to authors asking them to send them copies of any book that gets well-reviewed. And the books will come in and take one look at it and say, no, I don't want that. I like to think that some of this is a vast library in Hollywood full of unread first editions, some of which will probably be quite valuable. And they're all stacked up like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark in this huge warehouse full of books. And there's a great heist movie waiting to take place there, isn't there?
Susie, I feel like you and I might have been in production companies where we've seen a version of those libraries.
And I've even seen a version of it from the other side now where, as a screenwriter, I'm also pitched novels by agents where they go, oh, we've got this book that we've optioned and the writer really likes you. Will you read it for a film or television? And CAA, who represents me in Hollywood, basically just send me millions of books. I'm like, please don't send me any more. I do my own work mostly. but, you know, it is interesting. Every now and then someone sort of gives you a book and says, what about this one? And at the moment I've got one that, you know, that got optioned and then I met with the author. So that was an interesting experience. And she's wonderful. And it's one that I really loved. And we took it out to market and they've picked it up and it's going straight to series. So that's really exciting.
Wow.
But it's a bit of a bestseller. It's a big company that want to do it. But I saw the whole process right down to me summarising the novel and pitching it as a TV series in a sort of different format, slightly different format. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, I suddenly saw how it all worked, what happens backstage, as I would say in theatre.
It's commerce and matchmaking kind of coming together, isn't it?
But they also buy up the options for loads of different novels that are on certain lists. Mm. So they'll just go, buy all the options on the top 10 of, you know.
Just in case.
Some of them go to auction as well. So the option is very high. That's why, and a lot of agents say to playwrights early on in their career, it was said to me early in my career, just write a novel and then we can sell it to Hollywood and then you can write a play. I went, but I want to write a play. I don't understand this logic. Now I kind of get what they were trying to do, but at the time I just thought, you're looking at me, a playwright, telling me write a novel first and then you can write a play.
So don't playwrights have a potential second career in script doctoring? Have you been asked to do that?
Yeah, I won't do that because, I don't like working on other people's scripts, but you know, I think the interesting thing about playwrights in the TV rooms are that playwrights are an interesting add-on in the TV room because they think about the unified whole. Mm-hmm. So, you know, often I'm in television rooms where everyone's pitching ideas, and I was in this room once in Australia, I have to point out, in Queensland. Hope no one's from Queensland here, but I'm not saying it's about Queensland. You're from Queensland!
But go on.
I sat in a TV room with a group of male screenwriters who were all sort of trying to pitch ideas for various characters, what they did, and I was the only woman. And I said, what about the woman? She's a really major part of it. And they all went, oh, yeah. And one of them goes, let's make her Amish. And I went, Amish in northern Queensland. I said, well, she doesn't even get a car. Like, this is crazy. And that's the best you can come up with for this character?
The Brethren, anyway. Sure, but not Amish.
Yeah.
So, Susie, I mean, because you write across forms, I'm really fascinated by this because I feel like when I've kind of switched gears, especially for the first time, I'm like, oh, why don't writers write like that over here? Like, for instance, you know, like in the theatre, I'm like, oh, like the actors are involved so soon. Like, why don't we bring them in so early rather than doing
the director
as well. What have you learnt from each
I have learnt that theatre compared to screenwriting is the hardest form, but it's the most collaborative and also the best thing to take as knowledge into a television room. But I think if you're trained in theatre, you have learnt certain ways of collaborating and sharing ideas, but you also think of the whole piece as something that whenever you come up with, say, what will we do with the female character? Rather than going, let's make her Amish, you go, well, what are the themes and metaphors that we're playing with and how can we enhance that with what you know, so the form is the content. Yeah. And I think that makes great television. But I think that's something that playwrights and theatre people know very, you know, in their soul. But I think it's not necessarily something that people think about when unless it's prestige television or film. So I think that theatre, I think playwrights go to television and film thinking, oh my God, like it's so well paid and there's all these executives everywhere. So they're a bit anxious, but actually they bring with them a better skill set, strangely.
Yeah.
And now there's this great demand in Hollywood for playwrights in television rooms for that reason.
Well, it's like the Succession team. They were mostly from British theatre,
absolutely,
weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
Okay, so let's get the timeline straight. So there's prima facie the play, and then the next iteration of it that we, the audience, see is the novel.
It's
but
the
you
novel.
Were saying you wrote the screenplay before
First,
the novel.
But they should have written the novel second. So with my next play, which is currently on in London, I've written the novel. I haven't written the screenplay yet, but I have written the novel, and it was such a great thing to use the play and what I've learnt through the rigorous interrogation of the characters and the story, and then set myself free to rewrite it in a very long form and really sort of delve into the areas that I very much wanted to delve into in the play. But
is this Inter Alia or something
else? Inter Alia.
Inter Alia? Yeah, with Rosamund Pike. So what do you... I mean, I'm just picturing you at the desk as well. Like, what are you getting out of prose fiction writing that you're not getting from screenwriting, that you're not getting from playwriting, like each of the forms, what does it give you and what does it prevent you from
using? So playwriting is, I mean, when I write the play, aside from having written the play, you have this extraordinary, very well interrogated treatment for writing the novel. And so I'm at a massive advantage when I start to write the novel from someone that goes, what's my novel going to be about? But even aside from that is that all of the questions that actors have asked me over, you know, weeks and weeks of rehearsal, like, but why? Why would they do that? And you think, oh, I haven't been asked that before. So all of that interrogation has happened to some extent. It doesn't mean you don't work really hard on the novel, but there's this lovely feeling that the novel, I mean, I've so enjoyed being a novelist, probably more than I ever expected to, because writing a novel, there's this just sense of purity of being on your own and being able to really engage and not have to... I always say you get to dive down to the bottom of the ocean and build a world and no one can come down there until one of your kids knock on the door and goes, where's my jumper? go back up to the surface again. But there is something lovely about not having to think about... and publishers and book people, Pam McMillan, who I work with, who are fantastic, they're very respectful of the writer. Now, theatre's a bit more, you know, crash and bash, you know. It's like, come on, where's the script? Oh, no, we don't like that. We can't afford that set. You know, so there's a whole lot of other sort of, you know, like people sort of get their hands on it. But there's something lovely about the way people give a novelist the chance to actually reveal the story and to make something in its final form before it goes into a room with other people. And then the suggestions are very... You know, they're usually very sharp and thoughtful people that make suggestions, and they're also they're not people that are going to have to embody it on stage, so they don't have a sort of personal kind of sort of issue with certain parts of it. It doesn't mean I don't love theatre. I absolutely adore theatre. I am a theatre animal, but I have to say the novel has been this incredibly beautiful thing for me.
So am I hearing right that for you at least, the ideal pipeline is the play first,
yes,
because you get all of the beautiful collaboration and humiliation of, of working with other people to...
You also get reviews.
Forge, we'd love those. And then you've got the whole universe really set up in your mind for...
So that's if I'm doing an adaptation. If I'm just... I mean, I'm also writing a novel that's just from scratch, but there, it is a lovely thing to have written. And not every play will this will happen with, mind you. Only the ones that I feel like there's a strong story that I'd really like to write as a novel. And then the film is basically an adaptation of the novel.
Mick, you have met with these people and collaborated with these people who have brought your universes to life, and it strikes me that that is an incredible act of trust. So you've handed your works over to Morwenna Banks for Down Cemetery Road. She's actually also known as the voice of Mummy Pig in Peppa Pig. Is that correct?
I know.
I mean, what a multi-talented human being right there. And Will Smith for Slow Horse. Not that Will Smith.
The other one.
Will's the other one.
The real Will Smith.
And he's like alumnus from Veep and The Thick of It, right? Tell us about the conversations with Morwenna and Will and how you felt, I can trust these two with bringing this to screen.
Well, I met Will first, and this must have been at least 6 years before, certainly before it was shown on TV, maybe even before the cameras started rolling, and got to know Will. Well, one of the first things Will said to me on our first meeting was, this is all going to go very, very slowly until it starts going really, really fast. And he was right on both counts. For about 6 years, not much happened that I was aware of. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. But, I mean, a whole year would go past with my hearing nothing at all. I'm more or less forgotten about it. It's bubbling away in the background.
And did you think that nothing would happen as a result of nothing happening in those years?
Pretty much, yes. Yep. Which I thought was what I kind of suspected, which, you know, didn't worry me particularly. But they were doing a lot of work that I didn't get to hear about. And then things started happening really quickly. For two reasons. One is that a guy called Graeme Yost came on board. He is essentially behind the scenes Hollywood royalty. He wrote Speed. He wrote the movie Speed. That's what we're talking about. That was his first job. He's done a lot of things since. And it became apparent once he was on board that this was now something that was going to happen. And the next thing, of course, that occurred was Gary Oldman being cast as Jackson Lamb.
That's great.
Now, I found out afterwards that I never got told about anything that didn't work out.
It's true.
I only got told about the good stuff.
Yeah.
And I found out afterwards that various people had been approached for various roles. I mean, various roles in the production, you know, director and that kind of thing. And it had been turned down by a lot of people. I think, as with most new ventures, people look for a reason to say no. They don't necessarily want to commit to anything new, unless they're sure it's going to work. So they got a lot of no's, and then Gary was a yes, and suddenly a lot of the people who'd said they weren't interested said, hang on a minute, you know that thing we were talking about last year? I can't get it out of my mind. I'd be happy to do it. So from that point, it started happening, and the writer's room was set up. And Morwenna was in the writer's room. Morwenna did a lot of writing on the first four series of Slow Horses. So I'd got to know Will, completely trusted in what he was doing, because I was there in the writer's room while he was... you know, sort of conducting the band, as it were. And Morwenna was in the room, and we all... it was great being in the room. I thought it would be awful. I mean, as we've established, the great thing about being a novelist is you go into your room, you shut the door, and you don't see anybody. It's fantastic. I love it. And I didn't think that being part of a collaborative process was something that would appeal to me. My feeling was that I'd spend most of the time sitting in a corner with my arms folded, saying, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. In fact, I found it a very energizing experience because they were all very, very respectful of the material, far more so than I would have required. And there was something really extraordinary about the fact that they were talking about these people, these characters, as if they were real people. They also expected me to know stuff about them.
It's true.
I didn't necessarily. I mean, anything that I didn't put on the page, I've got no idea. And it also became apparent that this was... Slow Horses, the first novel, was the one they started off with. At the time I was in the writer's room for that, it had been I'd written it 10 years previously. And they knew it a bit better than I did.
Yeah.
There was one moment where they were talking through a scene with me, and they said, and this is the point where Jackson Lamb will say to River Cartwright, bleh, whatever the line was. And I went, that doesn't sound like something
in the book.
Jackson would say to me. And they looked, and one of them said, Mick, it's in the book. At which point I just accepted that they knew what they were doing.
So can I get clarification? You are in the writer's room, and what's your role there? Like, are you working alongside them? Are you there as an oracle? How often are you in the writer's room? Where were you placed?
I would be in... I mean, if the writer's room went on for 3 or 4 weeks, I would be there probably a day or 2 days a week during that process. Okay. I think maybe right at the beginning, they might have thought of me as the oracle. That stopped very, very quickly. You're talking about the things that get discussed in the writer's room. Quite genuinely, in the Slow Horses writer's room, the very first question that would be asked every morning, once everybody had turned up, you know, settled down, opened their laptops, taken their coats off, was, what are we having for lunch? Every single day.
It's true. Someone would come around and take your lunch order.
Absolutely. Yeah. I loved it. I did love that.
It's actually the most fun. Have you been in a writer's room?
Yes.
It is the most fun for writers who normally write on their own to be in a room with other people that write.
I heard the cutest story the other day. Yeah. So a friend of mine who only works in theatre, has traditionally worked in theatre, was brought into his first writer's room and he brought a packed lunch.
Oh, but that's so true because playwrights never
get
anything.
Playwrights don't get
shit.
And
they're like, what? They go, do you want sushi or do you want
the passing of the menu is the most joyous thing of the writer's
incredible.
Room. Yeah, absolutely.
And the free stuff, like all the
We're just going to talk
like,
about food now. Just let us indulge.
I mean, I'm getting all
for a while. And the snacks.
Yeah, no,
the snacks are really good. Okay, so...
Can I just say one thing,
yes,
though?
Please,
I was in a writer's room in London for some big office for Universal, and they had a wall of moss. Like a living wall of moss. I'm like, this doesn't happen in the theatre. We're all like touching it, going, this is amazing.
Oh my God, that
so
is amazing.
So it's for your well-being.
Yeah. So, yeah. Moss on the walls, kombucha on tap. Yeah, that's very Hollywood.
Taking us behind the scenes into the writers' rooms and inside the creative minds of global hits like Slow Horses and Prima Facie. You're hearing from award-winning playwright Susie Miller, best-selling British crime writer Mick Herron, and asking the questions on stage at the 2026 Sydney Writers' Festival is Benjamin Law. And Natasha Mitchell joining you for Big Ideas, our live event show. Do you have a favourite adaptation, I wonder? A book that came alive in a different way on the big or small screen? What was it? I'd love to know. The Radio National text line 0418 226 576 0418 226 576. Or do you get a bit gnarly when an adaptation departs too much from the original work? Let's head back to the conversation.
Mick, how important to you is fidelity? That's not a general question about your life, but...
his wife's in the audience.
His wife is in the audience. Hi, Joe. How important to you is fidelity to the original source material? Because there are entire Reddit threads devoted to the differences between the original source material and the book. I mean, we were talking backstage about the casting of Roddy Doyle. Like, you didn't expect, like, this hunk, this Australian hunk, to be playing him necessarily. That's a slight aesthetic change. But in terms of story change, how important is that to you? Does that concern you?
It isn't. I mean, novels take place on the page and the reader does a lot of the work in their head. And in order to put that onto a screen, you've got to change an awful lot. I write, as most novelists do, with a great deal of interiority. Mm. When I'm writing about a character, you know what they're feeling, you know what they're thinking. Mm. To put that on the screen could be quite dull. You have to find different ways of putting that information there. Mm. Lots of changes have to be made also for logistical reasons. You know, the availability of actors is another thing. Mm. And in Slow Horses, it has to be said, you know, we have Gary Oldman playing Jackson Lamb. If you go through the books, he's there, about a fifth of the novel will feature Lamb. If you've got Gary Oldman, you want him in every scene.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a lot of, you know, shifting around of what the characters are doing. All of which I'm absolutely fine with. The fidelity idea is kind of, I understand it from my perspective as a reader. Mm. But as a writer, I think that the TV version has to be its own beast if it's to be successful. It has to have an independent kind of life.
Mm.
And I'm very happy with with those changes that I made. They're the bits I find most interesting, to be honest, where the bits that I didn't come up with, you know, that somebody else has written.
I have to say that having read Mick's novel, I don't know how many other people have read it, but it has a dynamism around the dialogue, which I can see why people optioned it straight off. Like, there's just something very, very modern about the writing and very much lends itself to the pace of television. So, you know, without you even realising it, you wrote the perfect novel that to be picked up for television.
I think we stopped there. Without realising it, you wrote the perfect novel. We'll end the quote there.
Oh, sorry.
and I'll put it on the next paperback. Thank you.
We're all the same, right? What do you mean, for television?
That is his next endorsement on his next novel.
Absolutely.
You talked about, you know, the joy of being in a writer's room, especially coming out of, you know, this solo practice as well. What about the joys of being on set? Because you have made kind of Hitchcockian cameos in Slow Horses.
Did you?
Is that a surreal thing where it's like this thing that I wrote in this room, actually originally not expecting anyone to read it, now is a three-dimensional set with all these workers working on it? What is that like for you as a writer?
It is wonderful to see the number of people that are involved in making a TV show. It's like a mobile village. There are dozens, hundreds of people all doing stuff that needs to be done. And I've got no idea what any of it is. It's really, you know, it's a completely different language. But yes, Joe and I have made cameo appearances in a few of the episodes, a few of the series. Sometimes when I get asked about this, I say we're in every series in order that people will watch very, very carefully. And we haven't really. But yes, in this very first episode, we are a couple leaving Chinese restaurant. And I'm carrying a takeaway. Now, if you watch it, it looks to the world as if I am carrying a very hot takeaway. It wasn't, it was stone cold. That's acting. That is acting. Yeah. We then became... I tried pitching this to the director, a spin-off series, couple leaving Chinese restaurant who knew too much. And that's in development now.
Yeah. But
we're also a couple leaving hotel and hailing a taxi. I do all my own stunts. I got that. And a taxi screams to a halt.
That's great.
I mean, this couple are recurring characters. They obviously have a life of their own, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Quite
what
an
are they
interesting
doing?
Life by the sounds
Absolutely.
Of it.
And there's obviously some kind of backstory there because we're wearing evening dress at about 11 o'clock in the morning. No idea why. But the next time we're shown, we will be far more visible because in the next series, we're couple sitting at a memorial service. And because we're a couple sitting at a memorial service next to Christian Scott Thomas, I think the camera will linger a lot more than it has done in the past.
You might need some rad attracting acting skills before that. Susie, for those of us who have been following your work, we have seen stills of Cynthia Erivo wearing the wig.
Oh, yes.
So does that mean that the film is shooting now?
It's wrapped
it's
and
shot.
Done. It's about
done.
To be released, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, later on this year.
Do you make a Hitchcockian cameo at all?
No, I didn't even think of it, to be honest. I think I've done my legal years. But I do have to say that the production was very excited when I came to set the day that they revealed the Old Bailey, which was built utterly like the Old Bailey.
Wow.
And, you know, you sort of get into an old warehouse in Richmond somewhere in London, and you sort of walk in through all this, you know, paraphernalia and steps and whatever, and then they open this door and there's the Old Bailey.
Wow.
It's quite astonishing, actually. And, you know, you can run around and be as irreverent as you like. And so that was pretty amazing. And then watching Cynthia do the... And in fact, I said to Cynthia, oh, come and stand here. She goes, oh, I don't want to stand in the dock. I feel really scared. I thought, oh, yeah, I guess for most people, courts are intimidating, even when they're not real. But, I mean, she was lovely to work with. And what was interesting about it was the adaptation to the film. I thought there's only one point in doing it is if we actually push the story further. And so we cast a non-white actor because I felt like in the first iteration, Jodie very easily garnered empathy amongst the audience. But actually, you know, there's a class and a feminist kind of, and a gender argument in the play. And then when I wrote the film, I thought, what if we push it further and we actually add race to it, which is a very, you walk into a room, people know straight away. or what your race is. And so I worked really closely with Cynthia to develop the issues that would be different for that character, and also how to, and we worked with these fabulous, I mean, I don't know if people have seen the last series of Industry with a young guy in it who works with, God, I don't know his name, that's my problem, but he plays her younger brother, and also Noma plays her mother, and they're just, we had this lovely time in rehearsal space, which I didn't know you got in film, so it was just like being in theatre, where we kind of worked through it and we practiced it and we played with it, and I rewrote the scene so it really fitted with the dynamic of that family, and I think that was a really special anchoring part of the film. But also, you know, you realise that, you know, as a young black woman, as a barrister, she said, I don't think I'd make the kind of jokes that Jodie could make, or that, because I feel like I'm constantly be vigilant about being serious and being taken seriously. And, you know, it was just, and we had a whole lot of barristers come in to talk to us, and, you know, a whole lot of young black women barristers talking about the differentiation between what it's like to, you know, what some of the things that had happened to them in court and so on. So it was a really learning experience for me as well, which was just wonderful. And, you know, and I made a good friend out of Cynthia Riva, which I was, I have to tell you all, because she sent me a text saying, I think you're the most wonderful person on the planet.
But all hang on, right, but hang all on. Right.
But that's my daughter, wallpaper now, right? My daughter saw the text and she goes, on the planet?
Tone it down.
Yeah, yeah, right down. I mean, it was just one of those throwaway things where my daughter like, on the planet? God.
That's pretty special, though.
Oh, she's really lovely.
And,
yeah,
you know, when I heard that it was going to be a film, like, that's that first level of excitement. But knowing that she was cast, I mean, that whole dimension of being a black woman working in defence, as well, like, it just brings up all those other discussions about your place in the community too.
Yeah.
It makes me also think of how this play has travelled the world. We mentioned that at the start. It has been performed in so many countries and in so many languages. And I'm wondering how, I mean, we're talking about adaptation, but it's really interesting that, I guess, other cultures have adapted it and taken it into their own. How does it land with different audiences and different legal systems as well?
Well, they have to use the same legal systems, because I can't actually rearrange it for every legal system. But, you know, there is some funny, I've seen five of the international ones. And the one in Athens, I remember they said, she catches the train home to Liverpool, but they have a big sign of the underground. I went, you can't catch the underground to Liverpool. It's actually out of London. But anyway, so little things like that are funny. But I sat there sort of in Italy, and actually in Oslo, because I went to the one in Norway, which at the big Ibsen Theatre, National Theatre there, which was amazing. But, you know, I sit there and I don't speak the language. So I sit there going, I'm not quite sure where we are. Then I hear Cambridge. You go, oh, that scene.
Yeah.
And there's obviously one little peppered with, or like Julian, I think we're in that scene now. So it's so different. Every single production is so massively different. And that's what I love about theatre, is that every time it's reenacted, they take their own community's version of story. But each one of the actors, like so many of the actors, have won these major awards, which really excites me. I think, oh, I'm so pleased that these young women get a chance to really show the depth of their talent. So,
has any reaction, reception, especially in a different culture or country, caught you off guard or surprised you?
Yeah, I think I was surprised it went to China and had such a massive effect in China. And there was something different. I mean, the Chinese production was extraordinarily beautiful, and they had this great actress, Zili, who had just won Best Actress at the Venice Film Festival. And she just does this phenomenal, and the production was huge and very, it went around the country. But there was one thing about it, there's this issue, I don't, anyone who's seen it or read it, there's this thing about the mother giving her daughter this pink shirt that's completely inappropriate for her wearing to court. But in China, they made this exquisite designer pink shirt, and then they put it on the market as something to sell through a fashion label. Huh. And it sold out to all these women and they wear it as a kind of emblem of the sisterhood and of like women's rights. And I thought that was so beautiful. I thought, wow, this, like, I just wrote pink shirt, you know, in my little room.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's all these women in China in their suits with this really beautiful silk shirt that happens to be pink because it was in the play.
Wow.
And it was a different kind of way of thinking about something that I had said, 100% polyester pink shirt was sort of the sort of thing your mum gives you that you can't wear to court, but they made it a silk shirt. It was just really nice.
Wow.
I don't know, it made me happy.
That's really, really cool. Mick, you've been working alongside people in the screen industry, and I'm wondering two things, like, has it made you want to do screenwriting in your own right, and has working with these people changed how you write as a prose writer?
Short answer is no to both questions, so it's quite straightforward.
Moving on. you don't want to be working at the, you know, in final draft writing these scripts?
No, I don't. As I said earlier, you know, writing a novel is largely about interiority, and that's where I live, you know, that's the stuff that I really enjoy doing. I would find it very difficult, I think, to do what you do and put it all on the... Yeah. Make it all available, you know, to an audience straight off like that. I couldn't do that. Mm. Does it change the way I view the characters? No, I don't think it does. When I first saw any of the dramatisation going on, which was on set rather than on screen, by that stage I was writing Bad Actors, which is the eighth novel in the sequence. So I was pretty well established in what I do and how I do it. And I've never had a particularly visual imagination. I work on the page. I work with words and you know, the level of the sentence and the paragraph. So I don't have a picture in my head of Jackson Lamb, either an original one or one that's been, you know, replaced by Gary Oldman. I have a voice, and that's what I'm writing to. And the same is true of all the characters.
Has seeing Gary Oldman in that role, has seeing Emma Thompson in that role affected how you see the characters? Because these characters continue to live on in the series and the books.
They don't when I'm writing at all. And I haven't written the Zoe character for a while, so it was kind of startlingly new to see Emma Thompson doing it. But I've managed to hang on to the original versions such as they were. As I said, they weren't pictures, they were words. When I first introduced the character of Jackson Lamb back in, you know, page 20 of the first book or whatever it was, I mentioned, and this was perhaps the one sentence of my novels that I regret, that Jackson looked like Timothy Spall gone to seed. And for ages afterwards, I would get emails from readers saying, do you know, if they ever make a TV show out of this, you know who'd make a good Jackson Lamb? Timothy Spall would make a good Jackson Lamb. And I was thinking, yeah, I told you that. But the reason I said that was not because I thought that was right, ideal. Yeah. It was because I'm not very good at writing physical descriptions of people. I never know what my characters look like. So for that reason, I've never had a kind of constant description to go to you know, say what they look like when I reintroduce them in each book. I thought if I mention an actor that most people know, that does all the work for me, you know, readers will do it. So then when Gary Oldman was cast, I've had people say to me, you must be really disappointed that one of the world's leading character actors has been cast as... when you clearly wanted Timothy Spall to play him. I said, well, no, because Timothy Spall has actually cleaned his act up a great deal since I first wrote that description. Whereas Gary Oldman has gone to the dogs. So Gary Oldman actually does Timothy Spall gone to seed far better than Timothy Spall does these days. So I'm very happy
That's
with
great.
That.
That's great. I love it.
Susie, I've got a theory in that, you know, all writing is a kind of fitness, right?
Yeah.
And that different types of writing is a different type of exercise,
exercising different
kinds of muscles.
Oh, I love it. That's so intellectual. Mine is like, it's, you think of a house and which tradie is doing which job. Like,
oh,
you...
okay. I mean, that's hot. But what what do you feel like you have strengthened by writing across all of these forms? Like, what kind of writing fitness has each of the forms
I
given you?
I feel like the novel has given me space. Like, uh-huh. I've actually got space, interior space where, in theatre, you always have to write. I mean, when I was mentored, Edward Elby mentored a few playwrights in Australia, which I was lucky enough to be one. And I remember he always said that theatre is an oral, even though you go to the theatre, he said it's basically an oral landscape. It's actually the symphony of the music of the words and the ideas behind that music. And that really very much resonated with me. And he said, whereas when you go to the cinema, it's much more of a visual experience. And and a novel is completely separate again. And I feel like a novel kind of covers the whole landscape because you can actually really say what you mean. But the joy of theatre sometimes is that you have to embed in each line. It has to do five things. It has to tell you something. It has to have energy around it. It has to extend on character a little bit. It has to do something that surprises people sometimes. I mean, there's so many things that one line has to do that people don't realise when they read a play, but actually when actors are speaking them, it becomes very clear. And I think the other thing is, and I'm sure Mick would agree with me, that when you write dialogue in a novel, you learn a little bit from other sources of writing dialogue, or you do it naturally like Mick does. And part of that is that it's not what you hear when you're on the tube or on the train that you write down. It's what the energy of that conversation is and how to do it in a way that keeps the energy of the conversation. And I think that people think, oh, you know, do you just listen to people and write it down? No, but you get it's the dynamism of the way people speak that's interesting to you. And I think that makes interesting dialogue, and it says the same thing, but it does it in a way that's slightly artificial, but it's more compacted. So in a way you kind of affect people and they sort of lean into wanting more of it. But each one has been a really big learning experience. And to be honest, it's not a bleed into one into the other. They're completely separate ways of being. It's just that you always work with words. So you have the same kind of tool. It's just that you bring another tool in each time.
That really is an extension of the tradie metaphor. I love it.
You do love it.
I've just got one more question for each of you, and it's the same question. You know, Mick, you started off this session by pointing out the fact that, you know, you didn't set out to write books to be adapted into television necessarily. And Susie, I imagine like when you were writing Prime Facie, it's like you're focused on the play, right?
Yeah.
Can you each share with us a moment where, I don't know, there was like an audience reaction, a reader reaction. We're like, I am so glad that this original piece of work I had was, in your case, platformed by other people, developed into this other life. And in your case, you stretch yourself to write a different incarnation of it.
Ooh. I think most of my surprise reactions have been the way that Gary Oldman's portrayal has been taken to the hearts of so many people. It's wonderful. He's playing a pretty disgusting character, isn't he? I mean, he's very, very unpleasant.
But I think he farts more in the book, though, right?
having sat next to him on set or in between takes, that coat that he wears, it stinks to high heaven. I don't know how it stands.
Oh, my God.
But people seem to love him, and I think that's I think it's quite strange, but I also think it's wonderful, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Susie?
So for me, I mean, in theatre and film and television, the thing is just watching the set come up and the actors start to own the set. There's something magnificent about the three-dimensionality of it. And I think with novels, for me, it's when people come up to me with the novel and say, this is my story, you know. And there's an ownership because they can read the novel and they can stop and start when it gets a bit intense. Whereas in the theatre, you're sitting there going, it's just there, it's happening, there's no way out other than to walk out. So I feel like with the novel, people have actually said, oh, I feel like I could be in this story. And there's something really lovely about thinking that you connect to people in that way. But certainly the visual concept of seeing what you just made up come into being is, you know, it's quite flawed. Actually,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
everyone. Can you please join me in thanking our wonderful guests, Susie Miller and Mick Herron?
So many irons in the fire for today's guests. You can catch season 6 of Slow Horses on Apple TV from next month, or read the 9th and latest instalment of Mick Herron's Slough House series. It's called Clown Town. Susie Miller's new play, Strong is the New Pretty, premieres in Brisbane from next week for the Brisbane Festival before heading to Canberra, Geelong and Sydney. The film adaptation of Prima Facie with Cynthia Erivo premieres at the Toronto Film Festival in September. Look out for that on Australian cinemas soon. And her play Inter Alia will be released as a novel also next month. You can read Benjamin Law's Dicey Topics column each week in The Good Weekend, and thanks to all of them and the Sydney Writers Festival team for that terrific conversation. If you want to get in touch with us at Big Ideas, email us bigideas@abc.net.au. And the show is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovits, and me, Natasha Mitchell, your host. Our sound engineer is David LeMay. Thanks for your company. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.